Welcome to Indie Newswire, a weekly review of breaking news published on independent media center Newswires from all over the world.
Today on the Indie Newswire is the 29th of August. Another huge ICE raid. Hundreds are detained in Mississippi. The international anarchist conspiracies fighting ICE on the topic. The Long Haul raid. We'll read from thelonghaul.org and Indie Bay's East Bay page. Information about the Long Haul info shop and the raid earlier this week. The DNC in Denver, you've just heard a whole bunch from. It's my pleasure to interrupt Democratic politics. But, you know, we'll also hear phones in the fridge. Cindy Sheehan's phone tapped at the DNC and hear a little bit from the streets. We'll speak from Al Rojas, one of the founders of the UFW. Information from the California Coalition for Workers Memorial Day about the growing number of deaths in the field this year. We'll discuss the state of organizing in the fields. Rojas wrote a piece, The Convenience of Complicity. We'll hear the piece and speak with him from San Francisco. Tomorrow is an International Day of the Disappeared in your community and everywhere, a day to remember, a day to take action. I'll read from elenemigocomun.net. And it's the third anniversary, of Hurricane Katrina hitting the coast of the United States. We'll hear the Katrina Pain Index 3 years later. All this and more on the Indie Newswire. Stay tuned.
Zero. Number of renters in Louisiana who have received financial assistance from the $10 billion federal post-Katrina rebuilding program Road Home Community Development Block Grant, compared to 116,708 homeowners.
Zero. Number of apartments currently being built to replace the 963 public housing apartments formerly occupied and now demolished at the St. Bernard Housing Development.
Zero. Amount of data available to evaluate performance of publicly financed private-run charter schools in New Orleans in 2005 to 2006 and 2006 to 2007 school years.
0.008 percentage of the rental homes that were supposed to be repaired and occupied by August 2008, which were actually completed and occupied. A total of 82 finished out of 10,000 projected.
1. Rank of New Orleans among U.S. cities in percentage of housing vacant or ruined.
1. Rank of New Orleans among U.S. cities in murder per capita for 2006 and 2007.
4. Number of the 13 City of New Orleans planning districts that are at the same risk of flooding as they were before Katrina.
10. Number of apartments being rehabbed so far to replace the 896 apartments formerly occupied and now demolished at the Lafayette Housing Development.
11. Percent of families who have returned to live in the Lower Ninth Ward.
17. Percentage increase in wages in the hotel and food industry since before Katrina.
20 to 25. Years that experts estimate it will take to rebuild the city of New Orleans at current pace.
25. Percent fewer hospitals in Metro New Orleans than before Katrina.
32. Percent of the city's neighborhoods that have fewer than half as many households as they did before Katrina.
36. Percent fewer tons of cargo that move through the port of New Orleans since Katrina.
38. Percent fewer hospital beds in New Orleans since Katrina.
40. Percentage fewer special education students attending publicly funded, privately run charter schools than traditional public schools.
41. Number of publicly funded, privately run public charter schools in New Orleans out of total of 79 public schools in the city.
43. Percentage of child care available in New Orleans compared to before Katrina.
46. Percentage increase in rents in New Orleans since Katrina.
56. Percentage fewer inpatient psychiatric beds than before Katrina.
80. Percentage fewer public transportation buses now than pre-Katrina.
81. Percentage of homeowners in New Orleans who received insufficient funds to cover the complete costs to repair their homes.
300. Number of National Guard troops still in the city of New Orleans.
1,080. Days National Guard troops have remained in city of New Orleans.
1,250. Number of publicly financed vouchers for children to attend private schools in New Orleans in program's first year.
6,982. Number of families still living in FEMA trailers in metro New Orleans area.
8,000. Fewer publicly assisted rental apartments planned for New Orleans by federal government.
10,000. Houses demolished in New Orleans since Katrina.
12,000. Number of homeless in New Orleans even after camps of people living under bridge have been resettled. Double the pre-Katrina number.
14,000. Number of displaced families in New Orleans area whose hurricane rental assistance expires March 2009.
32,000. Number of children who have not returned to public school in New Orleans, leaving the public school population less than half what it was pre-Katrina.
39,000. Number of Louisiana homeowners who have applied for federal assistance in repair and rebuilding who have still not received any money.
45,000. Fewer children enrolled in Medicaid public health care in New Orleans than pre-Katrina.
46,000. Fewer African-American voters in New Orleans in 2007 gubernatorial election than 2003 gubernatorial election.
55,000. Fewer houses receiving mail than before Katrina.
62,000. Fewer people in New Orleans enrolled in Medicaid public health care than pre-Katrina.
71,657. Vacant, ruined, unoccupied houses in New Orleans today.
124,000 fewer people working in metropolitan New Orleans than pre-Katrina.
132,000 fewer people in New Orleans than before Katrina, according to the City of New Orleans' current population estimate of 321,000 in New Orleans.
214,000 fewer people in New Orleans than before Katrina, according to the U.S. Census Bureau current population estimate of 239,000 in New Orleans.
453,726. Population of New Orleans before Katrina.
320 million. The number trees destroyed in Louisiana and Mississippi by Katrina.
368 million. Dollar losses of five major Metro New Orleans hospitals from Katrina through 2007. In 2008, these hospitals expect another $103 million in losses.
$1.9 billion FEMA dollars scheduled to be available to Metro New Orleans for Katrina damages that have not yet been delivered.
$2.6 billion FEMA dollars scheduled to be available to State of Louisiana for Katrina damages that have not yet been delivered.
Years ago today, Hurricane Katrina made landfall. That's from audioport.org. I'm going to read now from the World Socialist website. More details of the immigration raid in Mississippi. The number of those arrested in Monday's U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement raid on a Laurel, Mississippi manufacturing plant is significantly larger than previous reports had indicated. Approximately 595 arrests have now been confirmed, making this the largest immigration raid on a workplace in U.S. history. The raid, which saw workers from Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Peru, Brazil, El Salvador, and Germany taken into custody, has terrorized the immigrant population of Laurel. Fabiola Pena, a 21-year-old mother, told the press about the moment the ICE agents stormed the Howard Industries factory. "I was crying the whole time. I didn't know what to do. We didn't know what was happening because everyone started running. Some people thought it was a bomb. Then we figured out it was immigration." The aftermath of the raid has left the workers and their families traumatized and confused. Bill Chandler, the executive director of Mississippi Immigrants' Rights Alliance, MIRA, told Reuters, "People are very, very fearful. People in the Latino community are afraid to go out of their homes. In many cases, they're afraid to go to work. Families have been separated, in some cases with both parents of a child held in custody, leaving children suddenly without care. If you have young children going to school and they come home and find their parents gone, that's a major crisis," said Chandler. The superintendent of schools in Jones County, where Laurel is located, says half of the 160 Hispanic students did not attend school on Tuesday. The ACLU has begun to investigate the treatment of those arrested, sending staff from its Immigrants' Rights Project to Mississippi. Attorney Monica Ramirez, part of the team sent by the ACLU, released a statement saying, "We are deeply concerned by reports that workers at the factory where the raid occurred were segregated by race or ethnicity and interrogated. The factory was locked down for several hours. Workers were denied access to counsel, and ICE failed to inform family members and lawyers following the raid where the workers were being jailed." Of the hundreds arrested in the raid, roughly 475 are now being held at an ICE facility in Gina, Louisiana, some 200 miles away from their homes and families in Mississippi. The prison system of ICE, the largest investigative arm of the Department of Homeland Security, is notorious for its record of abuse and neglect. More than 60 immigrant detainees have died in ICE custody since 2004. More than 100 of those arrested in Monday's raid are said to have qualified for an alternative to detention because of humanitarian reasons. Most are under house arrest or have been given ankle bracelets for tracking purposes. They will still have to face a federal judge and almost certainly be deported. 8 workers arrested during the raid have been charged with federal aggravated identity theft and could face up to 2 years in prison and a $250,000 fine if convicted. The defendants, 6 men and 2 women, appeared before federal magistrate judge Michael J. Parker in a Hattiesburg, Mississippi courtroom on Tuesday in shackles and handcuffs. They told the court, with the aid of an interpreter, that they could not afford their own attorneys and were each assigned assistant federal defenders. Appearing before the court on Wednesday, all 8 defendants were ordered to be held without bond. When public defender Abby Broomley sought to have her client Paula Gomez released on bond to care for her 5-year-old son who was sick, Assistant U.S. Attorney Gaines Cleveland argued against her with a customary coldness, saying, "She has been charged with a serious crime. We need to keep this defendant until the charges are resolved." Information is also coming to light that reveals the considerable damage done by the nationalist orientation of the trade union bureaucracies in the area. There have been reports of tension between union workers and immigrant workers at the raided factory, and that some of these workers applauded as the immigrants were being arrested. The Associated Press spoke with union and immigrant workers who described resentments over the amount of overtime immigrant workers received, sometimes up to 40 hours per week, while union members were discouraged from working overtime. A union member is said to have given the tip to authorities that initiated the investigation of the plant. Robert Schaefer of the Mississippi AFL-CIO, responded to the raid in a way one might have expected. "Jackson, Hattiesburg, Laurel, and all areas along the coast. It's a little Mexico. I'm not against people trying to make a living. I have compassion for those folks, but at the same time, the taxpayers of Mississippi shouldn't be subsidizing a plant that won't even hire their own workers." Again, that's a quote from Robert Schaefer of the Mississippi AFL-CIO. The anti-immigrant positions of the trade unions have only aided the efforts and cleared the way of the U.S. government to terrorize large sections of the working class with raids like those in Mississippi and Pottsville, Iowa, earlier this year. That's from a World Socialist website, WSWS.org. And in response, I want to read something posted to IndieBay, the Central Valley page, by the International Anarchist Conspiracy. It's communique number 6, Fighting ICE, regarding the manifold ways in which ICE can be fought. I thought it fitting. Countless nights have been spent gazing into the seeing stones. Many things have been seen inside those murky depths. Everything in there is black. The future holds much darkness for everyone. We see it spreading already, outside our very doors. The barbed wire fences stretching for miles. The animals in the desert prowling at night for someone to kill. The camps nestled in our backyards. The camps where people hold tightly onto their friends as they slowly die. The camps holding mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers away from each other. The largest branch of the Department of Homeland Security is ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. ICE agents have walked through malls, guns in their hands, and searched for people who looked illegal. ICE agents have pulled mothers away from crying children. ICE agents truly believe that the people they detain have no human rights. Because of this, someone just died in a detention facility. They died because they did not get their medication. They died in a cage, surrounded by a powerful apparatus that did not view them as human. Many people simply do not know of ICE's existence. The raids and terror do not directly affect them. Some people ignore what ICE is doing. Some people are forced into ignorance by the system's control of information. Regardless of all that, the raids continue, with ICE growing all the time, more brazen in its efforts. The question is, how do we wake people up? How do we spread knowledge of what is transpiring around us? The first problem is that no one is hearing about ISIS activities. The second problem is that when people finally do hear about a raid, it's from the government's media and paints ICE as an entity that still has a few kinks to work out. The third problem is that when people actually hear about a raid from someone they are close with, they usually have no idea what they could actually do about it. First problem, a good way to expose ICE to the general public is to disturb or otherwise warp the everyday lives of the good citizens of the U.S. This can be done with flyers, graffiti, wheat paste, flash mobs, wands. If enough witches and wizards are present around an ICE office or other building, passersby might wonder what all those people are doing. Every action on the part of ICE should be met with audible and visible outrage against them. The only way to break the spell cast on everyone is to break it. If we want to have any hope in revealing reality to those blinded to it, our efforts have to be relentless. Second problem. The cheap monsters employed by the government's media might mention the raids now and again, but is always within their discourse. Those who seriously tune into CNN tend to believe what CNN tells them. All the news on television is presented in such a way as to make the viewer feel a sense of inevitability. The news rolls on and on, one story and then another, all seeming to be graspable, digestible, contained. Reality on the television is a controlled reality, where everything is taken care of in advance. Those watching this reality can do no more than sit in their chairs and watch the machine run its course. We need to use all of our powers to bring back reality to those under our enemy's spells. Reality must meet them outside their doors. It must be something they step into, not out of. If people are late to work because some witches and wizards pissed off about something called ICE were romping down the street, reality has met up with them. If people learn that the building next door with broken windows is connected with ICE, reality has met up with them. The reality painted on CNN will begin to look out of focus if there are disturbances on the street and none on the screen. Remember, it is their media. The only thing we can hope to do is feed their spectacle with images. We can never break anyone out through the government's media. We have to do that with our wands. Third problem. When people finally have broken the last of our enemy's spells, there should be something they can do about it. Many people are not aware of their own abilities and strengths. These things have been made to seem unimportant in this capitalist nightmare, but if people are encouraged to use their gifts in any manner they choose to, they would find themselves capable of many new things. No one should be forced to join a group or formal organization just because they appear to be the only option for resistance. Resistance should be constant, diverse, cooperative. Everyone is capable of resistance. Our magic should be falling on our enemies from every direction. When everyone understands that every single day that passes is a chance to fight against the dark forces that fill their minds with shadows, the earth will shake and spew fire. A world of fences and cages is the world the government wants. They want every human being within the borders of the U.S. to be subservient to their plans. We are all supposed to serve very specific roles in their economy. When we do not, when we grow uncontrollable, we are put back into place, or at least they try and put us back into place. But they can never control all of us, no matter how thorough they are. We care as little for their plans as we do for them. We will not listen to them. They do not value human life above their dollar or their law. Nothing about this country is going to get better for a while. The U.S. is quickly disintegrating and shifting into overt fascism. But with this shift, we must expand the resistance or face the darkness we have all glimpsed in our seeing stones. They must be opposed whenever possible because they will not stop. The buses keep arriving in the detention centers, and the raids continue. The land is destroyed by the capitalists, creating millions of refugees who then flock to the centers of global capitalism, where they are attacked once again. They have no hesitation in what they are doing and continue on their death march, hoping to take all of us with them. If we do not wish to join them in the hell they have created for themselves, we need to be constantly in motion. Good night, comrades. Remember that we will get through the dark times. They do not understand the magic which is all around them. They have their guns, and we have our wands. Affectionately yours, the International Anarchist Conspiracy, the IAC. Posted to Central Valley, Indie Bay, page. I want to read one more thing to you and play a song. It's a call to action. A call to action for tomorrow, August 30th, International Day of the Disappeared. In your community and everywhere, a day to remember, a day to take action. Freedom to all political prisoners, appearance of the disappeared. In solidarity with the international call from the Association of Families of the Disappeared and Victims of Violations of Human Rights in Mexico, and by the Latin American Federation of Association of Families of Disappeared Detainees, we of the Solidarity Without Borders delegation call upon groups in the United States to participate in August 30th as a day of remembrance and a day of action for those disappeared and detained. As repression rises across the United States against immigrant communities and communities of color, as political prisoners continue to struggle for freedom behind bars, and more dissidents are taken captive as terrorists under the pretext of homeland security, as Immigration and Customs Enforcement imposes a reign of terror with raids, roundups, deportations, detentions, and disappearances, as the government strips detainees of their rights from Guantanamo to Iraq to black sites across the globe, as private corporations, multinationals, and security contractors profit from every detention, disappearance, and incarceration from our communities to occupied territories abroad, make August 30th a day for memory against forgetting, a day for struggle against silence. As the U.S. exports their repression globally to serve and protect its corporate interests, to enforce its capitalist agenda on the world, as the U.S. sponsors state and paramilitary violence against people's movements in Mexico, such as the Zapatistas in Chiapas and the popular struggles of Oaxaca, as the U.S. continues its 30-year campaign to silence those who resist in Latin America, from Plan Colombia to Plan Mexico and on to the Security and Prosperity Partnership, as occupying forces continue to disappear thousands of people from their homes and streets in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Haiti, and beyond, as those who commit these crimes against humanity have never been brought to justice, and as impunity reigns in the halls of power, make August 30th a day to globalize our remembrance, a day to globalize our resistance. On August 30th, we also stand in solidarity with those commemorating Black August in memory of the freedom fighters, those still struggling in New Orleans and beyond on the arrival and anniversary of the arrival of Katrina, those mobilizing for political prisoners and for immigrant rights at the DNC, and those mobilizing against the RNC, those struggling every day in their communities and behind bars. This August 30th and beyond, we unite with our sisters and brothers in affected communities to demand freedom for all political prisoners, the appearance of the disappeared, not one more raid, not one more deportation, not one more detention, not one more murder. What shape could the August 30th Day of Action take in your community? A march of silence? A disappearing? A direct action street theater? An action at your local detention center? An act of solidarity around the DNC or RNC? A display of the faces and names of those disappeared or detained in your community? A dialogue or forum with the names and communities hit hardest by repression? Building local coalitions? Supporting existing movements of resistance in your community? It's up to you. Educate, agitate, organize. For our dead and disappeared, not a moment of silence, but a lifetime of struggle. From Oaxaca, Mexico, and struggle, the Solidarity Without Borders delegation. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. This is the Indie Newswire. That was a piece from El Enemigo Común. And stay tuned. We'll have Al Rojas on the phone pretty shortly here. I'm going to play a quick song, or a little bit of a quick song, and we'll join a video of Al Rojas speaking on farmworker deaths and the UFW conference. There's a video posted to Indie Bay of him reading a piece called The Convenience of Complicity in the Fields of Death. So we'll hear him reading that in just a moment, and then we'll have him on the phone to talk about what's going on in the fields as this agricultural season advances. Stay tuned, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org.
Message I want to convey that connects with why we're all here. I call this the piece called The Convenience of Complicity in the Fields of Death. Many times in our lives, we come to some point in which our values and convictions are challenged and tested, and so doing, We hope that we have learned from our mistakes and from our experiences and the decisions we make. But more importantly, the question we ultimately need to ask of ourselves is, do we recognize our faults and accept our ultimate responsibility for those decisions which will severely affect others, especially when we have assumed that responsibility in the end, if not maybe even becoming complicit in a party in concert? Several days ago, I wrote an article in which I openly criticized the complicit relationship of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and the president of the United Farm Workers Union, Arturo Rodriguez, and their connection with the federal government's attack against workers in this country, and their close relationship with the illegitimate president of Mexico from the right-wing party of the PAN, Felipe Calderón, which I consider all three responsible for the support and the continued support of the economic policies of federal and state that continued the exploitation and the forced expulsion of millions of Mexican workers who arrive in this country having to cross a fence or a border through the most arid desert conditions, and where more than 5,000 men, women, and children have died to come to the American dream, to come to simply work in this country, when at the same time in Mexico the minimum wage today is 50 pesos, which is $5, less than $5 a day, which is what any Walmart in Mexico now pays those workers. This we consider to be a concert, in concert with the U.S.-Mexican government and the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and many others who have pushed these anti-immigrant attacks against workers, and in instituting the issues of racism and denying immigrant workers the right to be able to survive and to support their families. In our criticism of the United Farm Workers Union, we indicated their failure to invest time and money to organize and mobilize the farm worker communities and being a visible presence in those communities in the fields. By doing so, the union would begin to be a viable and visible force in the agricultural fields, putting pressure on the growers and the corporate interests. And abide by the very laws that the UFW and the California State Legislature and the governor agreed to enforce in the protection of workers, when in fact the UFW and the legislature and the governor signed a law that supposedly was supposed to protect workers as it relates to injuries in the fields, as it relates to heat and protection for those workers. Which now brings us to the most recent tragic death of a farm worker by the name, a young woman who is pregnant, by the name of Maria Isabel Vasquez Jimenez, a young woman who crossed the border, leaving her family behind in Oaxaca, to come to this country, to that dream, the American dream. She died of a heat-related fatality. Maria became the occupational victim in violation of state regulations that were heavily lobbied by the United Farm Workers Union and approved and ultimately signed by the governor into law 3 years ago. And in reading the news articles of the tragedy, many of us see the pictures of Maria's friends' painful grief and their support for the family's pain and anguish. I can remember vividly in those same pictures in my mind many, many years ago during the UFW strikes in the 1970s, when the killings of farm workers during the strike activity, and seeing the pictures of the black and white UFW flags in mourning now for Maria. And to me, this was a flashback to the past. The governor came to the funeral to pay his condolences at Maria's funeral and issued a statement released Wednesday afternoon saying, "Maria's death should have been prevented." A very profound statement, I believe, when in fact, both the United Farm Workers Union president and the governor stood there in front and looked into the eyes of the grieving family to, in essence, to wash their hands as it relates to the responsibility that lays on the governor for the lack of enforcement, on the part of the governor in instituting, instead of having hired enough staff to go out and do the work necessary as it relates to in the personal workers. This law that was signed by the governor, in essence, lacked the deterrence as it relates to punishing those who violate the law. This law has no accountability as it relates to the certification of the training of those employers or contractors or supervisors. Therefore, the employers at whim decide whether they want to follow through with the law. And in this case, we believe that the industry cooperated in, and also was complicit in the death of this particular worker. As of this day, there have been 9 deaths so far in the last 3 months of many workers only in the areas of the agricultural fields. In other words, here we're talking about the death that was the governor, as he stated, preventable.
101.1, www.freakradio.org. You've been listening to a video of Al Rojas reading a piece, The Convenience of Complicity in the Fields of Death. And Al is on the phone with us here live, so I will fade down the video. And Al, can you hear us all right?
Yes, I can hear you. Good morning to you and the radio listeners.
Wonderful. Thank you for being with us. I'm interrupting the video where you're just talking about the case of Maria Isabel Vasquez Jimenez and the organizing that's gone on since and the her tragic death in the fields that the show reported on a couple months back. But if you could talk about what's happened since then and give a little bit of a general discussion as, by way of introduction of what's happening in the fields this year, because it's not an isolated case.
Well, you know, even though these incidents are extremely important because you're talking about people dying in the fields or in the workplace, this has been a very common situation. In the last, 5 years, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention issued a report indicating just Latinos or Hispanics that have died in workplace injuries related to their jobs have been well over 780 people in the last 5 years. Tragically, we've had an increase of these deaths in the field in the last three years since a law was enacted as a regulation. Now, mind you, I was at one time a UFW organizer for many, many years, and we were able to see back then the kinds of conditions that set these things off. But I have to address the fact that if there's no visibility of union activity and union pressure, organizing, mobilizing, these things continue to be a problem. Now, we have to, I guess, look at Maria's death, what we believe to be maybe the real problem. And the real problem is that the terms of the law. The language in the law was approved by the UFW, working with the Office of the Governor. Their intent was to try to rectify and all of a sudden, use this as a means to rejuvenate their sense of, being there in the field. But it's after the fact, and it's not before the fact. What I mean by that is that only after people die does the UFW react. And in so doing, for the last several years has developed a very cozy relationship with the governor. So when this issue came up with the deaths in the field, and you look at, scrutinize the law and the interpretations of the law, that were the language approved by the growers, the governor, and the UFW, you understand why people like Maria may have died. And that's because the deterrence in the law are not there. In other words, the law was sunset legislation, meaning that it was temporary at the time. It's now become permanent. But if you look at the law, basically it doesn't talk about a mandated requirement that the supervisors in the field, foremen, the employers, and the farm labor contractors have to have training that actually certified by Cal OSHA. Cal OSHA has no language mandating versus may versus shall. In other words, it was permissive on the part of the employers in order to train or not train those foremen supervisors. Now, Had there been a requirement mandated, it would be a different story today. But the real story here is that, you know, where is the UFW band as it relates to putting pressure and applying pressure in the field? So we're looking at the complicity of this whole question of the relationship between the growers, the governor, and the UFW when they approve legislation that basically is meaningless, has no teeth in the law, that deals with enforcement. I spent practically 27 years with the Department of Industrial Relations, one as a state deputy labor commissioner, and having adjudicated laws, understand the meaning of enforcement and deterrence in the law. I met with the regional director of Northern California for Cal OSHA, and the very question I asked him, what makes it mandatory for Cal OSHA to require an employer, armed labor contractor, or a former supervisor to show the certification of that training that is mandated and required by law? And he says there is no language in it. So when we look at this, we look at the fact that the UFW, instead of coming in and condemning the actions of the government, the state government, and the governor's auspices of this legislation, and agreeing to this legislation, which is meaningless, and without having to deal with any empowerment of the workers of coming to redress it. Now they're moving on this whole issue, Cal OSHA. But in the background, you see the UFW comes to the state capitol pushing a law for card check elections, which is great. But in light of that, they go down to their knees begging the governor, while at the same time workers are dying, and not condemning and denouncing the governor's policies, when in essence he has done nothing as it relates to enforcement.
So this,
only after the fact.
So this legislation that we're talking about then was designed to protect workers in this kind of exact case, but as you say, it's toothless. It's without any kind of enforcement mechanism.
That's correct. And the reasons for this is that we believe that the UFW is in a very weak position, not having organized workers. When you look at where they're at as it relates to being able to apply pressure on the governor, well, it's about how much work you've done out in the community to organize that pressure. The state government only works when people apply pressure and making sure that those laws are enforced. Now, if the UFW was there to do what, you know, we intended it to do when we founded the Independent United Farm Workers Union and joined with the NFWA back then, back in the mid-60s, it would be a different story today. But what you have is a complicit relationship with a Republican anti-union, anti-labor, anti-immigrant governor who they have a strange relationship with. And I think a lot of this happens to be the overall politics of where the UFW is now at in condoning the continued expulsion of workers from Mexico, in this case, farm workers,
well,
as it relates to guest worker programs, and we can get into that later.
Exactly, yeah. We were just talking about the most recent ICE raid in Mississippi, which turns out to be the largest ICE raid on a job site, on a workplace in U.S. history. And there was a quote from someone from the AFL-CIO saying there were union workers applauding the raid, like physically, like outside applauding as folks were rounded up. And that, you know, so this tension between establishment unions and the establishment labor movement is coming to light with regards to SEIU and the teachers unions in Puerto Rico. This is nothing new, unfortunately, but the UFW recently had its convention. And I'm looking at photos here that were posted to Indie Bay, and Fabian Nunez is speaking, and Robert Kennedy Jr. There's plenty of Obama signs. Hillary Clinton spoke. And what I see is a union that is pretty far from the fields. You mentioned earlier the visibility of organizing being crucial. Where has the UFW gone? How is this distance from the difference between Hillary Clinton speaking and a grape picker speaking is pretty wide in my view.
Well, if you look at where the U.S. value has been, I would suspect that they've been in the legislative arena. They've had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars from their economic funds, political funds, generated from the workers' contracts back in the late early 70s. So where they've been is that they've their strategy has been to pander to the legislators at the state capital and now at the federal level. I'll get into that. And what they've done is that they've been in bed with these lobbyists, thinking that laws are going to be enacted to help save the union by organizing. And I'll never forget when we met with Cesar Chavez and all the leadership in La Paz. I was an organizer for many, many years. And, we were all jubilant, with regards to the law, the Agricultural Labor Relations Act. And Cesar said to us, a lot of us may think that this might be a real historic moment, and it's an important moment for farm labor and organizing, because we have now this new law. He says, but I really believe, sincerely, he said, that this may be the death of the union. And many of us, questioned. We said, well, why are you saying that? And he said, simply because the only three powers that we have, which would be organizing, the strike, and the boycott, are only real powers to going out to the street and then emboldening workers and empowering workers. When we depend on legislative laws, we fall right into the hands of the growers, the attorneys, and the courts, and we'll have the same thing happen to what happened to the labor movement in this country, where the National Labor Relations Act came to be. And it's been a disaster with amendments to the Landrum-Griffin Act and the Taft-Hartley Act, which basically have been amended to stifle the organization of workers. And since then, the labor union movement has plummeted from what was 35 million workers down to maybe less than 18 million workers today and declining. And you see that happen with the UFW with regards to this strategy of having to buy off these Democrats who believe that, and they encourage the union, the UFW, that the laws are the best way out to organize workers. And we disagree, because unless they're out in the field organizing, which they have not, and investing time and money, because there's leadership there, then they're in a dream world, because in essence, this is what the Democrats and the Republicans want. They want them to deal with laws that basically tie the workers' hands in the courts, and in where workers get demoralized with regards to what even their claim right now. They're claiming that the LRB does not work. It does not work. Why? Because in the end, you have to go back to the workers. You have to go back to the rank and file. And when you look at the UFW, they got a lot of good people, a lot of good hearts, but you don't have workers. Almost half of the people on the executive board have never worked in the field, have never been farm workers themselves, and they don't have workers that really have come from the rank and file, from workers from the ranch. If Arturo Rodriguez lost the presidency today, the question to him would be, are you going to go back to what ranch to work that you came from many years ago when you came to work for the union? So when you look at the leadership, at the rank and file, and you see what's happening, there's a lot to say about that strategy of organizing Democrats and Republicans and having a close relationship with the governor and failing to denounce him and condemn him for the lack of having done more than just going after the employers after the fact with negotiated fines. That is a custom. I saw it while I was a state deputy labor commissioner, where fines were adjudicated by resolving them, by reducing them from $10,000 or $50,000 down to maybe $500 or $1,000 fine. That's a slap in the hand. That's where the UFW makes its error when it relates to or lack of organizing the fields and being visible in the fields. What month are we in today? We're in almost in September. We're in the height of the grape season. And the question is, where is the UFW? Why are they not there? They're instead in Mexico, meeting with the right-wing government, anti-union government that in Oaxaca last year, they killed 23 union teachers and supporters and an American journalist out of indie media, Brad Will, that to this day, nothing's been done. What does Arturo Rodriguez do? He meets with the extreme devil of the reason why workers come to this country and they're being expelled from their country. And now we have, and we can get into it, now we have this strange relationship where Cesar Chavez and Ernesto Galarza fought the evil system of the Bracero system, contract labor, indentured servitude program. And in light of that, now we have the UFW at the last convention just this weekend had already endorsed legislation a year and a half ago, the Ag Jobs, which is the Bracero guest worker program. And now they asked the workers to now, this weekend, to pass the resolution after the fact. Well, they've gone ahead without the auspices of a community referendum in the community that affects all immigrants, union and non-union. And here we have now a union has gone to the degree that they've gone to. And no one's questioning them. And I feel that, you know, after many of us invested our lives and people died in the field for fighting for the right to build a strong union, and we see this happening, we're all accountable to each other.
Alvarojas, you were an early member of the UFW, a founder, in fact. And so this critique is coming from a place where, as you said, you've put in a lot of hard work and effort to build this union. The story of a meeting with Calderon is a story I haven't heard. If you could explain to readers and listeners specifically what you're talking about with regards to meeting with the head of Mexico's PAN party.
Well, for some of us who may not know a little bit of history in the last several years, there was an election in Mexico in 2006 where there was fraud committed by the powers that be in Mexico putting in place through the auspices of the U.S. government, the Bush administration, a right-wing extreme government in power, which is the Felipe Calderón, we call the illegitimate president. And there's a movement in Mexico to fight, you know, the right-wing's policies. And he came to power because of the multinational corporations like Walmart, Home Depot, Costco, PepsiCo, and major U.S. banks and foreign banks supported the whole question of going after, again, the whole issue comes back to oil. Mexico had nationalized their oil back in the mid-1930s. So now those oil companies have never forgotten that they were told to leave. So Calderon has been supported by the UFW because they are the government, and they're wanting to expand at the federal level the whole question of the continuation of forcing people to leave Mexico on the basis of, you know, reasons of extreme poverty, which is the reasons why the teachers' union fought for better working conditions and decent wages and benefits in Mexico last year, and people were murdered over that. So what do we have? We have the UFW meeting with and courting at the federal level this whole question of legalization for workers with the tie of guest worker program, meaning that the UFW is not concerned about the 6 to 10 million workers in this country, let alone the agricultural workers, but, you know, that are free to work in, under the extreme pressure of the deportations by the U.S. government, Immigration and Homeland Security, that you have them now going to Mexico, signing agreements to have the Mexican government, state government, recruit workers for the guest worker program and handing those workers over to the UFW as if those workers did have a right to decide, one, whether they want a union and which union and belonging to the union and having acknowledgement. So you have a paternalistic view of how they deal with workers, no different than what they call in Mexico charro unions, company unions in Mexico. And you're seeing now Felipe Calderón, supported by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the anti-union governor, and invite Arturo Rodriguez this last February to come and eat and meet with this illegitimate president from Mexico, a right-wing government, responsible, we understand clearly of what's happened with workers who say, por el derecho de no emigrar, for the right not to migrate, those workers are fighting the multinational corporations. So what is Arturo doing? He's attempting to consolidate his leverage at the federal level with these political parties in this country, the U.S. and Mexico, with federal legislation to expand the Yes Worker Bracero program in order to organize workers, rather than organizing workers in the fields here in California or any part of this country. And meeting with him is meeting with the devil, the enemy, who is the culprit, the reason why people through the North American Free Trade Agreement, who sponsored the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the reasons why since 1994, which a lot of Democrats don't want to understand or don't want to, or may not know, and they don't know, Bill Clinton signed off on the North American Free Trade Agreement. And people like his wife sat on the Walmart board for many, many years. And we know who Walmart is. We know who Walmart is in Mexico. In Mexico, they pay $5 minimum wage a day for 10 hours work. So here we have the UFW meeting with Felipe Calderon this last February, wheeling and dealing with the anti-union governor who just these last few weeks has been telling the Public Workers Union, SEIU Local 1000, I'm going to pay you the minimum wage because I have a budget deficit. And we know why there's a budget deficit. So I'm getting back to Felipe Calderon and Arturo. There's a strange relationship here, cozy, between the Republican anti-union politics at the state level here in California. And there's reasons for that, because California exports to Mexico almost $20 billion worth of goods. But what we get back in return is poverty, with people being forced and expelled from Mexico because of lack of jobs. And now we have UFW meeting at the federal level. Even Obama supports the guest worker program, and we're mounting a campaign to address this, that he's wrong on that issue. The issue is that workers don't want to come to this country. They only come here to work. And if they're here, we should be able to go out to the field and organize those workers. But the UFW has chosen to sign contracts with farm labor contractors, guest worker contractors, in this country. In the state of Washington, the last 3 years, they've signed up workers that are coming in as guest workers that work in federal territories in the United States, from Vietnam and from Thailand. And they've been very quiet about that. And now this weekend, they passed a resolution at the convention. We were there. We opposed the guest worker program, opposed the fact that the union taking that position of organizing guest worker workers. When really the only reason guest workers come to this country is because the grower is saying, I can't find any workers. But let alone that, they don't want to pay a decent wage. And that's where the UFW is in error, because if they were out there working, organizing workers, the growers would be pressed to pay a decent wage, and the union pressing the growers, the corporate growers, to sign union contracts.
So we're talking about... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
We're talking about a climate in the fields and the workplace on both sides of the border, where there's a lot of repression, where the difficulty of crossing back and forth because of ICE enforcement in recent years, and the whole debate over immigration reform and legislation has made for a much more volatile situation on the border. There's a lot of fear in communities due to these ICE raids on this side of the border, and on the, you mentioned some of the political unrest and intimidation and repression on the Mexican side of the border. So it sounds like the climate in Mexico and here in the States for workers, particularly for immigrant laborers, is one where there should be, the conditions are ripe for some organizing, for some actual legitimate advocacy, for some groups and organizations to stand with these workers who are being attacked on both sides of the border.
That's right. That's right. And that's where the UFW should be. Now, mind you, they were very critical of Obama when Hillary was running because they supported Hillary. But no one wanted to say, hey, wait a minute, why are we going to support, a family, Clinton family, whose husband, although he might have a good record in the economy and having done some great things, he supported NAFTA. He supported Operation Gatekeeper when Operation Gatekeeper became militarized at the border. He failed to lock in the labor standards and protection and talking about the issue of immigration and the North American Free Trade Agreement. He allowed the opening of, lowering those tariffs for those Midwest farmers to dump massive amounts of corn into the agricultural industry in Mexico, where it depleted the chances of competing with subsidized U.S. farmers, to where they had many of them through a North American Free Trade Agreement, a clause in the Constitution to end the whole question of agrarian reform. So what does that mean? It means that some workers were forced to sell their land to come to this country. Now you have this tremendous repression, violent repression against workers who came to this country, not just yesterday or 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Some
exactly.
families that have been here 15 and 20 years, mm-hmm. who have kids in school, who are undocumented, who live under fear, not knowing if they're going to go home and find their parents there, not knowing if they're going to pick up their kids at school and their parents under fear while they're attempting to survive. And you have the Bush administration who basically, and then the Republicans and the Democrats, who created this problem. But yet, when we address this whole issue with the fact of this fear, and God knows that, the Bush administration, since 9/11, has issued a campaign of fear in general, and more so now with, this whole question of the immigration issue. Did we hear anything about Obama talk last night about, truly about the immigration issue? Absolutely not. Why? Because that's the issue that no one wants to talk about, because it means we don't generate votes and the immigrant community doesn't vote. But they're wrong, because a lot of those immigrants who are feeling that pressure and fear still believe that there's an opportunity to make some changes. But nevertheless, there's a tremendous amount of fear with regards to people coming out like they did in 2006. In almost over millions of people that came out of hiding, who were forced to come to this country to do one thing only, that's to work. And yet we have that repression, those deportations, those arrests, and treating people like criminals. And when they're not the responsible reason why they ended up here, it's we, our own government's economic policies, as it relates to exploitation here, exploitation in Mexico, with regards to the relationship we have with the extreme right-wing government in Mexico, and extreme right-wing government we have right now that hopefully we get rid of. And we change, what is being said, this whole onslaught on the immigrant community. Yes, the only reason I believe that community is in hiding, because those of us who should be out there to encourage people to end this fear that, that they have to hide and they can't come out of hiding and they can't come out to organize. We need to mobilize in those communities. And the fact is that the one thing you got to give credit to Obama is in 2006 in Chicago, in the largest demonstration there in probably the history of Chicago, he came out and he marched. Because he felt the vibration of the community. But where was the UFW? The UFW is Johnny Come Lately, after the fact, who they're not waiving the full rights for immigrant rights, but they neglect to understand that the immigrant rights movement didn't happen because of me or some of these professed leaders, and now the UFW wanted to take the banner of, the movement or some union. They were very, very cautious about moving into that arena back in 2006. It was a popular movement and encouragement by the fact that they were being criminalized by the Republicans and, to some degree, the Democrats. And in the end, the Democrats tried to sell out on the immigration issue to concede to something better than nothing legislation. And the immigrant community said no. And that's where that, now that onslaught, a retaliation by the Bush administration by coming after the workers. Do you see any employers going to prison? Do you see any employers being arrested and put shackled, you know, like if they were, like they did with the Jews back in World War II? Do you see any of them being prosecuted in the courts? Absolutely not. Why? Because most of them are contributors to the politicians who are in power. And that's the same old game. What we got to do is we all got to be accountable. And the UFW is no different.
So if we understand...
When we founded our union, the original United Farm Workers Union, a lot of people don't know this. It was independent. And we joined back then with the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, AFL-CIO. And we joined with the National Farm Workers Association, which is NFWA, under the leadership of not only just Dolores Huerta or Cesar Chavez, but Gilberto Padilla, Tony Arandine, and Julio Hernandez, and Epifanio Camacho, many other people. You know, you have, you know, people forget. You know, it wasn't just Dolores Huerta or Cesar Chavez. There was a lot of history there of a lot of people who are saddened by what they're seeing where the UFW is at right now. And they need to be criticized. They need to be criticized and put them right back in that same direction. We didn't commit ourselves to building a strong union and 42 years ago to see this happen with their relationship with the anti-union, anti-labor, anti-immigrant governor, Republican governor, and building relationships, the continuation of the expulsion of Mexican workers simply because the Walmart in Mexico and Home Depot and all these other multinational corporations are getting a piece of the action by paying $5 a day for 10 hours work. That's why people come here. There's a complicit relationship between all the people who are here and Maria Jimenez. We should never have died. But yet the governor hypocritically shows up and the union runs to put a flag over the coffin and then hands out little logo flags or union flags, and then decides that, you know, they want to march with the family, and then they go out on the website and ask for money to donate. And the question to me is, to Arturo and a lot of those members, why are you asking people to send you money for buses? When you march, you know, physically, you don't need a bus. You march, you know, and it's about sacrificing pain. That's what Cesar Chavez was about. That's why nonviolence for Cesar and having many of us commit to that was important, because we remember the onslaught of the violence by the growers and the court systems when we had a right to protest, we had a right to demonstrate, we had a right to strike, and we had a right to talk to workers in the fields, even if we went to jail and they sent us to jail. Many of us went to jail. Many of us. Many of us died. And that's why we're so wanting to hold the UFW accountable, that they're wrong. They're absolutely wrong with these complicit relationships with these anti-union people who are professing to be worker-friendly. The guy who sponsored the guest worker legislation in Washington, the ag jobs legislation, is the same guy who got arrested in a toilet in an airport terminal for allegedly soliciting sex in a toilet. A senator who is sponsoring the UFW legislation, a Republican. Give me a break. Even then, I question, you know, the Democrats, you know, because they're not without any guilt with regards to the direction of the labor movement in this country, and you begin to see even the labor movement questioning the fact that it's got to be a rank and file movement, got to be a movement of workers. And
exactly.
The UFW can no longer profess to say that the workers, when they've never been workers, they've never been farm workers, and they need to allow that leadership through the mobilization and organizing workers to take their union back and take it and run it. And the Chavez family needs to understand that they need to allow the workers to take their union if for whatever it's worth, and maybe even go back to working in the field.
So knowing that the both parties are complicit in this, and knowing that the corporate interests are lining up against workers, and knowing that the government of Mexico is equally complicit and repressing workers and organizing, and as you said, knowing that the UFW is essentially a paternalistic and a company union, what organizations are out there doing the work? What is happening in the fields such that the workers are able to stand up for themselves?
What's happening right now, there are many groups. There's the Immokalee workers in Florida, but on their own, they're doing organizing in Florida with tomato workers, and they've done a great job, you know, even though they don't consider themselves a union, but they've taken it upon themselves, workers, actual workers, not volunteers, who've taken lead to lead their union, their organizing effort, I'll call. Same thing's happening in the Valley here. There's a lot of small groups who are now sold on the idea that the only reason way this movement can come is if they take, you know, that leadership. You have the agricultural workers, the Organization of Agricultural Workers of California, OTAC, who is also, you know, a small group who has been doing a lot of work throughout the Valley for many, many years, and they have a workers' a newspaper, as well as we do. And we have other contacts with other committees through this immigrant rights movement where workers have shown their own leadership and formalized into their own committee. The UFW is living in a dream world. You know, and the fact is that the workers out there, not me, not because of me, but because of them, you know, who have chosen to say, Al, you worked with the UFW. What is their thinking? Why are they where they're at? And I have to address and try to, as hard as I can to answer their question. And the only answer I can give them is that they failed to carry out the very principles of why we founded the United Farm Workers Union 42 years ago. And almost 34 years ago, we handed this union to these individuals. And I believe we made an error because we should have democratized and reformed the union and given it to the workers instead of having volunteers come in, even though, you know, God bless them, they have all the good intentions of the world. But let me tell you, if you get a graduate studies degree from Michigan State University or Yale or that's great. But you shouldn't take the leadership of what belongs to the workers in the rank and file when it's the workers who should be able to direct their union and direct it politically and not inflict fear like when we went to the convention this weekend and we had a difference of opinion as it relates to their working alongside of the growers in this state to complement the continuation of guest workers to come here as contract labor because the growers say, I can't find workers here. When there's 7.2% unemployment, and if growers paid, you know, $11-$12 an hour, they'd have an abundance of workers. But when you have the UFW respond as well as Hillary did, that we have some people outside, you know, the convention who are opposed to the guest worker program. We said, yes, we're opposed. We're opposed for the very reasons of why you're placating to the same old game of the old Bracero program that Cesar Chavez fought against and Ernesto Galarza, the doctor, activist. That we don't need to have the union come and grab the newspaper, the organizer, from the hands of the workers and tear it from their hands and tear it up and denying them the right to information when they're supposed to be the union that is open and not feel like the workers don't have a right to, you know, alternative information. And I believe that a lot of the people who came in received some the same fear that the Bush administration has done to the immigrant community by kowtowing and intimidating them that we're the bad people and they're the good people. When, in essence, we see Fabian Nunez, ex-speaker of the assembly, who's no longer employed by the assembly as a political professional. He's now a lobbyist, as I understand. And he's now lobbying legislation. My question to him, who's paying you? And where are you getting this money? Do all of a sudden you have you just opened up your eyes to this whole question of this workers out in the fields dying. They've been dying for years. Why is it that now you just woke up after you lost your job as assembly speaker and then you're now looking for a job and somehow now you become the lobbyist pushing legislation at the state capitol? And the UFW going into lobby for that law, that they drop to their knees and they beg and they use this excuse that the reason they drop to their knees to pray with their rosaries in front of the governor's office, the guy who's got blood in his hand, as far as I'm concerned, we're concerned, and they're begging for a law. At the same time, saying that we're praying for our dead brothers and sisters. Give me a break.
That's quite an image. So, Mr. Rojas, your pieces, I'm looking online, and people can read some of your writing. You've been writing a lot lately about the conference and the Congress and the legislation. There's a piece, the UFW must return to its roots, going into some of the same things we've talked about, and there's a lot of information on the workersmemorialday.org page. Listeners can get more information there, and again, check out the Central Valley page of Indie Bay, where there's a video and there's that same piece that we heard and talked about earlier, complicity, the convenience of complicity. How can folks get involved and continue to learn more about what's happening in the fields on a day-to-day basis in California?
They can write to us. We're going to be going on a campaign on a referendum in the communities. It talks about this campaign on the guest worker program to let people really know by having a debate. And if they want us to come to their community, you know, want more information, they should write to us at the following email address. I think you have it there. It's N as in Nancy, A as in Albert, D as in David, M as in Mother, 916@AOL.com. Write to us if you're in your community, you're wanting to have us, you know, and help us, you know, build a forum to actually have a debate, because we're going to be traveling throughout the state and also throughout the country to create and mobilize awareness about why we should organize and why we should fight guest worker programs and why we should, you know, be talking about organizing workers who have the right to organize, irregardless of whatever. To us, all the workers that are free out there are independent, and they're all workers, irregardless of whether undocumented or documented or whatever you want to call. And we need to organize the workers. UFW is using this whole thing about the guest workers. I'm saying, I'm sorry, but we don't deal with governments and making relationships with especially right-wing governments and having them recruit workers without the workers wanting to, on their own, to be a part of, you know, their union or any union. We believe it, you know, that will, that power, of the rank and file should be determined by the workers themselves. So if anybody's interested, we're going to, you know, launch a campaign because we know that Obama is not a candidate for president. We need to get to him and tell him that he's wrong, that's not the way to go to support ag jobs, that only one sector of the immigrant community is the one we're talking. We're talking about full rights for all immigrants. Derechos para todos los trabajadores. Completo.
Mr. Rojas, thank you very much for speaking with me on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1. If you'll hold the line for just 1 second, I'm going to play a song and we'll take a quick musical break. But if you will hold
the
line for just a second, thank you again very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Freak Radio.